Yes, hello folks, welcome to the weekly Manchester United podcast. I'm the host as always, Phil Brown. Of course, join me with my excellent regular co-host, James from United Muppeteers on this Monday afternoon. Decent weekend for United, they had a win, of course. Last time we recorded this podcast was before the Newcastle game. I'm not going to spend an awful lot of time talking about that. It speaks for itself, but responded with a win at the weekend, a much needed win away from home. Not a great performance, but I went all the same. First of all, mate, how was your weekend?
It was pretty good. It was pretty good. And yours?
I think I'm still drunk. I had my birthday party this weekend, so right. I heard it was good.
Happy birthday to you.
Thank you. It was a good weekend, of course, topped off by the fact that United get a rare away win. In much the same style that they got an away win against Sheffield United, I would have to say, were they end up scoring a goal from outside the box to win the game. Not great. And, you know, not a goal from open play. It's a bit of magic, a mistake, bit of magic, goal, and that wins the game. We'll talk about Anthony and we'll talk about other things, but what was your take on the game at the weekend?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it's all bad in that there was a couple of good things, I think. I mean, while watching it, I certainly didn't feel inspired, let's say, during the match at all. That is for sure. I thought that United were overall, for the most part, I think probably second best for a lot long stretches of the game. Still, I thought they were very. It was very uninspiring in a lot of sense. I thought that it wasn't much different to usual, except without a lot of the calamitous mistakes, you know, going on. And some of it was, I would say, on purpose. And maybe I don't love the style, but I think a lot of how it played out was purposeful. I think it was pretty obvious setting up the midfield the way that it was. The idea was to kind of just skip it. You know, send it long, send it wide, and then kind of hope for something to happen. And eventually it did. Obviously took a long time and came down to, I think, Pelistri was doing the dirty work to win the ball back to Harry, the other team, to get it to Bruno, and somewhat of a, not the best shot, but a good shot that beat the keeper from outside the box. And otherwise it was pretty unremarkable, which is same as many of our games. So I don't have a lot of feelings about it. You know, I'm happy that we won.
Obviously one of the big talking points was the VAR, you know, and inevitably it brings up a lot of discussion about consistency. I'd actually tweeted the day before about, you know, the VAR needs to have a serious review and consideration about how it's being used. I think it has utility on the objective decisions, like goal line technology, unquestionably a success, right? It's either over the line or it's not. And maybe you could get some type of technology that would have answered the question about Newcastle, Arsenal, you know, and whether that ball is over the line.
And we had one of those moments earlier as well.
Brighton against Brighton. And the thing is, it comes down to subjectivity again. And you're saying, okay, look, I allow for some variance in subjectivity, right? You know, the dubious stuff can go either way. But in another game versus Fulham, Manchester City score a goal where Manuel Akanji is a mile offside. And not just a mile offside, he's blocking Leno's line of sight. Flicks his leg out, obviously impacts how the goalkeeper dives. He delays his dive until the ball passes Akanji because he's expecting to be redirected. Akanji misses it, and it ends up going under Leno. And then had he have moved earlier, he saves that shot. It's such an obvious offside decision. It doesn't get given. Yet this one comes across. Harry Maguire, and admittedly does, you know, put his leg out, but he makes, I mean, in my opinion, maybe I'm wrong here, doesn't materially affect anything in the play. Like, the goalkeeper doesn't change what he was going to do, the defense doesn't change, ball goes across the box, and that's disallowed. And I'm like, you know, I don't want to be one of these people that complains every week about referees, but this is, you know, you look at that penalty against City, and you're going, those are missed a million times. You may probably never see that given again this season, right? And going, how is it that you can give the Akanji goal, but not that? And you know, I expect there to be a little bit more consensus on things like that. That's a subjective offside. But to me, you know, VAR is not being used properly. And trying to, on the subjective stuff, it still comes down to someone's opinion at the end of the day. Right? You can't remove that from the equation. Yes, you can give someone more information, but when you look at the cost benefit, I preferred the human error, because to me that was much more excusable than this. And honestly, when Fernandez scored, James, exactly the same thing happened when McTominay against Burnley.
Yeah.
Or against Brentford. I'm like, what minor infraction? You know, did Palestri handle the ball? Did someone half eyebrow offside? Like, what? Because if you look at anything wrong enough, you'll find a problem, right?
I know.
To me, it's just killing the spontaneous joy.
Yeah, I would agree. It's been really, really tough. I feel like there's been way more I don't mind as much the goal that City got not being called offside if that was how it was consistently applied. And there wasn't, like, I guess my point is, if there was not a lot of intervention, I prefer it. You know what I mean? So I prefer goals like the one City got being allowed if it meant there wasn't this level of, and it was allowed, right? But it's not being applied consistently across the board. Example being last year in our game against City as well, we had a similar incident that they did allow where Rashford was offside and he ran towards the ball and then he left it. And then you could say certainly it impacted the play to some degree, right?
Yeah, you couldn't complain if I was given.
Yeah, you couldn't complain if they called it offside. I like that they didn't. I thought it was more fair that they didn't, because offside decoys have existed for a long time where you have someone standing offside and the ball comes in and they don't really move, or they move back and it goes past them to an onside player who scores. I think that's okay. I think that's a part of the game, you know, because otherwise you're talking where you need 11 players behind the ball at all times. You know what I mean? And nobody can be standing in a decoy. Nobody can be doing an offside run or something like that. I think it's a part of the game to allow those things. And so I think that less intervention would just be better. I just think, across the board, less intervention would be better. Maguire goals should stand. You know what I mean? We had that goal Johnny Evans scored, I think. Same thing. Where, you know, I don't think that Hoyland was really interfering with the keeper at all. He was just kind of standing there, you know. And I'd rather you see less intervention and those goals happening than trying to call it within an inch of its life by the letter of the law to where, like, yeah, Maguire's half an inch offside and then he sticks a leg out, but the defender's not going to get to it anyway. So if he didn't exist, that play doesn't change at all.
Other thing that I think it introduces is, once you delay a decision like that, where you've got a couple of minutes to make a decision, then all of a sudden a referee or someone in the VAR starts thinking about other things. Like, I want to protect Anthony Taylor out on the field because, you know, I don't want to reverse the Spurs decision against Chelsea, which was quite clearly a handball. Spurs equalized when it shouldn't have counted, right? I don't want to give it. And then the referee starts thinking about, the radio is going to be at Sky Sports, are going to annihilate me, you know, all the fans, you know, all the other factors start coming into influencing that decision. When they're made split second, those decisions, you don't have time to consider all these variables. But once you put, you know, a couple of minutes between making a key decision and not, I mean, referees are only human. We know that they're affected by the home crowd. right? Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't they be affected by a week-long scrutiny on Sky Sports where their integrity's questioned and the PGMOL got to apologize, and now you've got Arsenal and Liverpool releasing statements? The problem is whenever they get a decision made, you know, in their way, they'll be silent, right? That's why I don't believe it should make a big deal out of these things, because it's just a matter of time for one goes in your favor and your hypocrisy will be shown. But to me, once you do that, where you say, okay, we've got like 2 minutes between making this decision, all the variables start to affect a referee. Yep. And there's never a consequence for giving a decision against United, mm-hmm. but certainly a consequence for giving a 50-50 for them. And I just feel like, and I'm sure all fans have this confirmation bias, but I just feel like a lot of dodgy decisions that other teams get. Yep. I mean, you can obviously point to a Wolves game. I could have easily been a penalty. But again, I think after that, there was a week-long inquiry into it. And I just feel this doesn't help referees.
Yeah, it doesn't. It definitely doesn't. And I think that, it's – I think the type of thing that ruins it is that – is specifically the number of goals being taken away. Mm-hmm. Because you can accept it. You take something like Wolves, should they have a penalty? Probably, right? Probably in that moment in time.
Oh, yeah, but to me, it's a penalty.
Yeah. And so you're like, it's just really poor, because I'd trade that penalty for the 3 or 4 goals that we probably should have had in other games.
Yeah.
That would have counted for the Spurs handball that we should have got. That would have changed that game. For getting Garnacho's goal back on that incredibly marginal, if offside at all, call against Arsenal, for the out of bounds against Brighton. These were all game shifting moments when goals were taken away or should have been goals were taken off the table. Mm-hmm. And I would trade it for those. And I think that for the spirit of the game, for the enjoyment of the fans, and for the purpose of the entertainment itself, there has to be a slight loosening with regards to goals being scored, where you're not checking every tiny minutia of it. Yeah. You know, like offside, they were saying, well, we're going to introduce like a margin of error. I don't really know, you know, that's just going to become another tiny point. It's more like,
it's just another point to argue over.
Yeah, but exactly.
What is the margin of error? Why was it this week? Yeah. And this week it was this week, and I mean, it's subjective. And this is one of the reasons why I think they should use foreign referees, because they aren't subjected to the media scrutiny all week, so they don't feel the same pressure. And they're coming in, and not saying it's perfect, but also the utterly ridiculous situation where you have Premier League referees that have a commercial
relationship
with Premier League clubs. I mean, that to me,
that's crazy.
Honestly, that was allowed. Where Hargreaves didn't turn around and go, you know, this is going to cause a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, this, bear in mind, James, Howard Webb was someone that when United were winning trophies year in, year out, was subjected to this allegation. Mm-hmm. He was Manchester United biased by Liverpool fans relentlessly, despite the fact he was caught in the bar singing "You'll Never Walk Alone." But they, I mean, Rafa Facts, right, went after him big time. How he didn't see this coming, you know, to me is unbelievable. But anyway, that's another point. Another big concern about that game was the performance of Antony. Now, I don't want to jump and put the boot in him, and I don't want to, you know, pile on. But Antony, it's Erik ten Hag's fighting for his job right now, fighting for his Manchester United life. Erik ten Hag brought him to the club for 85 million. Not only did he bring him there, but he, as a result of him being there, Ten Hag has had to back him over other players. Mm-hmm. And beyond the fact his performance was atrocious, there was a time, I think it was in the first half, Harry Wilson's goes down the left, United's right, cuts inside and shoots. And when you mentioned Palestri there, he did the opposite, you know, fought to get the ball. Antony put the weakest leg out. Now, it ended up being a good save from Onana, and I'm like, that right there probably infuriated me more than the whole performance, because that's not forgivable. You need to fight for the guy that brought you here, right? Mm-hmm. If for anything else, because you should be one person on that team that goes out for Ten Hag and gives absolutely everything. And I'm watching him going, his petulance, you know, and you know the fact that he doesn't do anything. I'm just going, I know he's low on confidence out there, but I'm like, this is starting to really annoy me.
Yeah, and it's bad. I mean, it's bad. It's really bad, the situation with Anthony in that respect, because he's going to be viewed right now as a representation of Erik ten Hag at United. He's
just like Fellini was with Moyes, 100%.
He's part and parcel. You're joined at the hip, you know. He was brought in for enormous amounts of money. That's specific, you know, and you can blame people for that. But the only reason it went to that amount of money was specifically at the request of the manager to do it at that point in time. And yeah, it's been not just bad performances, but the attitude, everything. I mean, when you look at the last week, all things considered, a player who's been out of the team, without implying any sort of guilt or anything like that, he's been out of the team due to domestic issues and accusations and things like that. He has been. You still have to factor that in as a player and say, one way or another, this ongoing situation that doesn't involve an unknown person, but somebody that I know, that I have a personal relationship with, means that I'm not able to play right now and I have this situation. Okay. Yes. Whether innocent or guilty, it's still something someone has to be responsible for. Right. The circumstances around themselves and their personal relationships. Not had a good season last season, in my opinion. One league goal since October 11th, 2022, right? You have a player who Erik ten Hag has basically sent to, you know, the gulag in favor of you right now, that cost a lot of money to a previous manager. Against City, he comes on petulant, upset about not coming on earlier, kicks out at some players, looks to start a fight. Against Newcastle, comes in, puts in another bad performance, very weak, spineless, nothing really to recall, comes in and puts another one like that while your manager is under the most pressure. And I'm sure we'll talk about that in a moment. I think, to me, it's unforgivable. And I think one of the ways that Erik ten Hag could win back, I don't want to say lost the locker room, because I think we both agree it's a cliche. I don't think he's lost the locker room. I don't like that saying. I think it's nonsense. But I think one of the things he could do to maybe win back more trust with the players and more trust with the fans is to show the same level of what I, you know, if we want to say that these players shouldn't be coddled, if we want to say that they should have this high level of discipline, this high level, these high standards, and that, which I don't disagree with, to be clear as well. I think at some point you almost have to make a public showing of this. And, you know, like, you've got to put in a little bit of like, there's a little bit of a show that goes into taking the pressure off your back that works at times. Managers have done it over the years successfully. I'm not saying to like by targeting specific player one specific way, but they've done it in ways where, you know, Jose Mourinho, whenever he got under pressure, he would come out in his press conferences and just turn the whole thing around and start going after the craziest things and sometimes saying the wildest things just to get the pressure off his back. And a lot of times it worked. And he put the team behind him in a lot of ways. When he couldn't do that anymore is when he often got sacked, of course, but a lot, he went through many periods of pressure like that. Sir Alex Ferguson had his way of dealing with pressure. And I think that one of the best things Erik ten Hag could do to win a lot of fans over, which I do think he needs to do right now, because it's not like fans should decide on how things are going, but he is losing quite a bit of his, you know, what you call a base of support in there. And I think in the locker room, it matters too, and will increase the trust of the faith in him, is to make a tough call on Anthony. And I think he should see the bench for quite a while, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to comment about this, because I think if there's a couple of things I could point out that I think Ten Hag made a mistake on.
Yeah.
I think he made a mistake on publicly outing Jadon Sancho, because I don't think that needed to happen. I don't know what purpose it really served, especially when it was 3-4 days after the transfer window had just closed, where you're like, look, whatever happens, do this in December, not in September, when you've just had a really bad start. I get that, right? And I think there's an old from Warren Buffett, what is it? Praise publicly, criticize privately. Praise by name, criticize by category, right?
And I want to be clear, I don't mean call out Anthony publicly.
I'm not saying that's entirely wrong because Mourinho would, I remember going after Shaw and players like the character, you're going to respond. And to me, I think you know, that should be intrinsic. Like Anthony should turn around going, not only do I have to fight for my manager, I think he has to prove himself to his teammates to get their respect, because I don't think he has their respect. And I just think I think he is talented, James. I do. I think he has ability. And here's the thing about Anthony. If Anthony is on form, where he's realizing his potential, he's a very, very important player, and I'll tell you why. United have no fluidity, right? So there's no movement. So that means that individual players that have ability that can beat someone and make something happen are really, really important, because that's where a lot of your stuff's coming from. It's coming from off the cuff. It's coming from, it's not really coming from team play. Right, so he in this United team has the ability to be very, very important, because they need players that have ability that can do things in tight situations. I think he, I think like a lot of United players, his confidence is on the floor. But to me, when, and I know wingers and forwards don't want to defend, I get it, but the way he gave that ball away. And the way he was putting in the wasn't even half-hearted, it was zero-hearted tackles. I'm like, mate, that's unacceptable. That really angered me, because I was like, I don't want to pile on him, but that to me was more representative of his character than anything else. I mean, I remember when Rashford was playing for Mourinho, and he had Rashford very deep, and you know, Rashford clearly didn't like it. Part of that was because he didn't trust Luke Shaw, and but he had to defend. And I think when you're not playing well, there's some things you can do that don't require confidence, intensity, you know, commitment, you know, dig in, grind the result out, and grow your confidence. But if you're not willing to do that, you're never getting out of it. And I just think, anyway, that bothered me. Do you have anything else to say on that before I move on?
No. I just think that, you know, obviously we'll move on to like the long-term plans, but you know, the Anthony one, I think is going to be really
good. I don't want to get to before we do that.
Go ahead.
Rasmus Højlund. First time I seen him show real frustration, right? You noticed it just not shortly before that when Garnacho shot, when he didn't put the ball across the box, and I'm going, it's 8 games he hasn't scored, but that's because United don't create for his kid, right? They don't, I mean, they just don't spend enough time in the final third. There's no cohesion with their movement.
Yes.
And you have wingers that don't want to create. I was listening to Guardiola talk about this, about wingers who dribble and stuff. And you look at, we talked about this last week, the way Foden and Bernardo Silva, what happened, the way they create for Haaland. You know, everything, boom, 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 in the middle. Højlund gets none of that. And you just see the frustration building. He got taken off. He was not happy, right? You know, Ten Hag's been asked a few times about this. Why is he being taken off? And, you know, we're trying to save him for this, for that. I'm not sure Højlund completely agrees with that, by the way. Because you could see that he did not want to come off in that game. And I really, really like him. Like, I think he has so much effort. But in some sense, maybe what United are doing right now is mitigation for a big Veghorst, because you know, he wasn't scoring either. United just can't get goals from the central strikers, and going, it was that his reaction was interesting. Anthony Martial should not be on a football pitch ever again for Manchester United. Anthony Martial looks exactly like you would expect if I came on.
This is
unbelievable how bad he looks on a football pitch.
Yeah, it is bad, isn't it? He looks like He looks like a player who does not have the fitness to play football anymore, but is trying to hide it, you know, just jog around a bit and, you know, obviously he has talent on the ball and things. So maybe jog around and hope he can get in a position that works or something, but he doesn't have it. But no, with Højlund, I think it is interesting because part of it is that I could imagine the frustration is that we tend to make the best scoring chances in the last couple minutes, right? When it gets a little bit chaotic. You look at the McTominay goals against Brentford. You kind of wish you had Højlund on the field for all these moments, right? Where at the end of these games, when Bruno scores and all that, you kind of wish you have him when it gets pinball-y, when you want a number nine in the box, when the ball's starting to bounce around and fly around and all of that. And so, you know, it's definitely frustrating. It's hard to tell the reason. You know, we haven't played with a center forward for real for a long time. Anthony Martial didn't really play as a center forward when he played either. Even when there was that year we scored a lot of goals under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Anthony Martial didn't play like your traditional center forward. I remember even there was a comment. It was he had a hat trick against Sheffield, and it was in post-lockdown in that little run of games there. And it was even talking about how, you know, he had finally gotten some striker goals, you know, that Solskjaer had asked him, you know, to play more like a striker and get some striker goals. And the only time I can recall we playing, you know, football where it served a number nine was when Cavani was playing. The few games that he played. And what's real interesting is, that was the season I went back and I was looking at replays of it a while back where, you know, Rashford was actually focused a lot on creativity.
Mason Greenwood was exceptional too.
And Mason Greenwood was too, to draw off some of the defense, to draw some attention. Because of course, Greenwood, similar to Rashford, was a player where you couldn't give him room, right? If he got on the ball.
And it's just too tragic.
It's that's a big loss from a football standpoint, obviously, all else aside, right? That's definitely something that affected the club and the forwards and the ability to do everything, because that's someone who was kind of taking up that right side for years, for a few years, and was building towards that in the future. But they don't play like they have a center forward. They don't play like they have ever played with a center forward. And a lot of times you get calls. And this is not a slight on Garnacho. He's a young player as well. But you got a lot of calls to bench Rashford for Garnacho. And when he plays, he does the exact same things that Rashford does. Exact same things. You know, it's not a criticism. I really like both of them, actually. And I think I said this before, but getting both Rashford and Garnacho on the pitch at the same time would be what I would like. Because somehow... because they're both threats, but they don't create much for other players all the time. You know, Rashford kind of had bounced around between almost being too much trying to pass the ball to Rasmus Højlund. We saw that at some of the Champions League games where he did get an assist to him, where he was really like, you could tell he really had to try, like put in extra effort to try to pass the ball. But Garnacho comes in for Rashford, who's, you know, wasn't fit. And same thing. I don't think he passed to Rasmus Højlund one time the whole game. And it's not the answer, you know, like there's not a personnel answer to this issue. You know what I mean? It's not a matter of benching one player is going to fix this, or starting this player is going to fix that. It's, you know, they have to figure somehow out to end it where this striker shift is such a graveyard shift at United, because it really is.
You know, I was thinking about this, and Garnacho, if you look at Garnacho, same look as everyone else, right? He's not, you know, no one is really playing well, right? With a couple of exceptions, let me say, Big Maguire, magnificent, again, right? Yep. 100%. And I'm glad he's proven me wrong, because I wanted him out in the summer, and I didn't see any way that this was going to happen. And I have to say, I didn't think that Johnny Evans would displace Raphael Varane from the team, and we'll get that in a minute. But like, if you look at United's team against Liverpool, right, So starting 11 was Andre Onana signed by Ten Hag, Diogo Dalot signed by Mourinho, Harry Maguire signed by Solskjaer, Johnny Evans an emergency one-year deal, Lindelof signed by Mourinho, Amrabat an on loan signing by Ten Hag, Christian Eriksen signed on a free, Scott McTominay promoted by Mourinho, Rashford was not his signing, and of course Rasmus Højlund was. So you go through that team and you look at it and you're going, and Bruno Fernandes of course wasn't his signing, but you're going, I know Ten Hag deserves criticism because he's not perfect, right? But United are still a mishmash of players from multiple managers that really should have been moved on long ago, where they should have been replaced. Where he does deserve criticism, I don't want to go back to that game, is the fact that he started Mount and Antony on the bench. Those are his players. And Mason Mount, again, raises questions about what was going on. We'll get that because you and I had a little chat about that earlier. But I have to say, you know, United looked a lot better at the weekend when Wan-Bissaka came in. Mm-hmm. Whole different balance. Dalot back on the left, whole different balance, much better. I mean, the improvement with Wan-Bissaka back there is just enormous. I think, obviously, the partnership last season of Martinez, Lindelof, Varane, and Shaw, who would fill in at left centre-back, I think that is so big of a loss for it that they just don't have a squad that can really deal with that. I don't buy into this stuff with Ten Hag, you know, doesn't know how to get United playing style. And there was a criticism over his comment that United can't play like Ajax. I really didn't see the problem with it, to tell you the truth, because if Pep Guardiola went to Luton, you think you've been tiki-taka? You play based on the strength of the players that you have. It's not any criticism of players, but they're just not so good to play that way. These kids at Ajax are coming through an academy from 8, 9, 10, playing a consistent style right throughout. Yep. Same as Barcelona. Anyway, so let's quickly get back to Rafael Varane, because this is a head-scratcher to me. Some of the things that I think Ten Hag has done wrong, and I don't know if this is a language issue, I mean, there was a comment, it was pretty funny actually, about Casemiro after the City game. I think it was the City or Newcastle game, City game, where they said, what was the situation? And he goes, no, he wasn't shit. He was just taken off because he was injured, right? So, but then he says, that comment that he made about Casemiro, we wanted to give him more football in the team.
Yeah, that he made earlier,
with Casemiro at all. He did not like that. And then saying that Rafael Varane was left out for tactical reasons, as you were saying to me earlier, did not go down well at all with Rafael Varane and
others too, because, you know, part of the issue is that Rafael Varane is another player. You know, there's one thing, Jadon Sancho, you touched on that he probably shouldn't have said something publicly. Jadon Sancho has friends in the locker room, but they're just that, they're just friends. It's not he doesn't have an influential locker room dynamic. Rafael Varane does. Rafael Varane is very much a leader in the dressing room in terms of how he's viewed. I know he's viewed as a player that calms things down, which he does when he plays. You know, he brings a presence, he brings a calmness, he brings an experience. And I know he's extremely well respected. And, you know, to say that he was confused would be putting it lightly. And to say that the rest of the team was confused would also be putting it lightly. And I don't know what the reason is for this, because since then, right, Rafael Varane has missed the game against Newcastle.
How many games has he played since that Galatasaray game? I was just trying to look this up on the phone here. Here, let me see really quick. So since that Galatasaray game, United have played Brentford. Did he play in that game? Let me see.
He played versus Brentford, didn't he? Yeah, no, he didn't. He was not in the squad. He was not in the squad versus Brentford.
Yeah, so I think he was poor in that game. And I think Ten Hag blamed him. Like, if you look at the one where Cardi straight through, dicks it over, you know, Varane is way too high, not paying attention to the Cardi behind him. And, you know, some of the goals that Neri conceded. But then you look at, you know, Brighton, everything, some of the goals they conceded have been appalling. But I think that Ten Hag blamed him a lot for that Galatasaray. Mm. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, he's not in the squad for Brentford. 6 minutes for Sheffield. On the bench for Man City. One minute versus Fulham.
It's that Galatasaray game.
Yeah, and it's kind of odd. You know, this is where there's been an oddity in the perception where some players seem to get a lot of blame.
Mm, yeah.
And it's hard to find a pattern. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, some players get a lot of blame and some players don't get any. You know, I think Rafael Varane, when he played prior to Galatasaray, was probably our best player to start the year. The first three, I know we weren't doing well, but the first few games of the year, he scored versus Wolves, right? He was the winning goal versus Wolves. Mm-hmm. I thought he played actually quite well. Mm-hmm. I thought he played well against Tottenham, even though we lost. I thought, I actually at one point thought him and Wan-Bissaka before getting injured were our best players to start the season. Played versus Crystal Palace 61 minutes. You know, that was his return from injury. He played very well in that game. And this is the oddity where, whether it's language or something, there's a view outside the dressing room from fans, and there's a view inside the dressing room as well, unfortunately, that some players get blame and some players get off scot-free on things that go on. And for some reason, it's not being communicated in a way that the players can understand to say, I see why I'm at fault for this. Or, you know, because maybe Ten Hag is right. Maybe, you know, he's a better manager than you or I. He's probably got a better ability.
Oh, to I think I've been lost in about 5 years because I reload every time I lose.
You would think that his analysis of the game is better than you or I. And if that's the case, and if he believes that certain players are more at fault and he believes he knows the reasons why, that is not making it through to the players in a manner that's understandable, and that is allowing them to fix it and improve on this situation. And that much I know is happening, because I know Varane has no idea why he's on the bench and it's not going well.
So,
I know that even Casemiro doesn't really understand what's wrong with what he's doing and what he's supposed to do to fix it. And I'm not saying Casemiro isn't injured right now, because I think he is, but I think I mentioned last time, it's the first time he's been in and out of a team like that, like practically his entire career. And that's weird. I understand his age and all that too, but it is odd. And you could see that there's some disagreement, that there was a bit of a lack of effort, that there wasn't the same, you know, never say die attitude that you would usually expect from a player like Casemiro that you saw last season. And there's something fundamentally broken in the way that Ten Hag is communicating it. And I think that he has to take some responsibility for that. I have to put some responsibility for that, because ultimately that is his job.
Of course.
And when it's Jadon Sancho, it's one. When it's Rafael Varane and it's Casemiro, you have to stop for a second and say, you know, I can no longer just say, look, it's just Jadon Sancho. You know what I mean?
I think whenever Ronaldo was coming out saying that he didn't think certain players were willing to raise their standards, I don't think he was talking about Varane or Casemiro.
Like, no,
they've shown over the course of their career, you know, many European Cups, World Cups, everything like that, being exceptional.
Yep.
But I think you do have a problem inside United where you don't have the authority that Pep Guardiola has to really carry through on threats. Right. So you can ask people to adhere to principles, but the part of the problem is the manager has been limited in terms of getting players to do things they don't want to do, because there's always a disconnect above them where you really have soft power as a manager. I don't want to use national stereotypes here, because this is not particularly fair, but like I said before, my father-in-law's from Amsterdam, right? He is Louis van Gaal to a T. And I mean to a T, right? Mm. So This I could go and ask him where his 1972 tax return is, and he will be able to pinpoint it. Like that's here. Right. He is exceptionally well organized, exceptionally well disciplined, and they have a demeanor. The Germans have this a bit too, but where they're very direct. Okay. Yeah. So when you need a bit of warm and cuddly, they're not the most it's just that they don't need to be up with the deliberately cold, but they're not the type of people to put the armor on you and go, it's okay.
Yep.
I remember Rooney saying about Van Gaal that Van Gaal was the greatest coach he ever worked with, right?
Yeah.
So I'm telling you that Ten Hag will almost certainly be an exceptional coach, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, truly brilliant. But one of the things that's concerned me that I see in United players is not so much the coaching, but the other side, the human side.
Yeah.
Where this is where a skilled communicator can sit down with someone and say, okay, I know how to spin. And I think Ten Hag's English is good, but most Dutch people can speak English well, but not perfect. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes, you know, the players didn't like Ranić because they thought he was cold, you know, and I know fans get fed up with this, but I think maybe sometimes Ten Hag is a bit too direct with his message, where he has very little, not saying nuance, but leeway for, you know, things that go wrong and you know how to put an encouraging arm. This is where it's really, really important that you have an assistant that can do that. Right. So if you're that way, you have to have an assistant that is the opposite of you personally. And I don't think Mitchell van der Gaag is. McLaren might be. Although I have my question.
I don't think so.
Stevie's leaking. But anyway. I think for Ten Hag, and this is, you know, they're very, very principled. They are. So he won't be questioning his methods, you know. And I just think sometimes that's where maybe, you know, that can be a shortcoming, maybe.
Yeah. Right?
But anyway, brilliant coach, no question. But when we talk about Casemiro, for me, I don't know if he's getting old because I can't judge him because everyone's been off. But I just seen, we said this from the very start, the body language has been wrong from the window.
Yeah, it has. Yep. Yeah, and obviously, I think that's right. I mean, I think the two biggest things, if I were to say with Ten Hag, because it's hard to tell tactically, I'm sure he's a smart manager. I'm sure he's a smart guy tactically, coaching-wise, all that. But the two biggest things I would talk about are recruitment, which I think has been really poor, but I think we'll talk about that in a minute, and the man management, the personal side of it. And that is a tough thing to learn. It's a tough thing to adjust to. And it needs a lot more support from the club too. And, you know, just to kind of segue into another point here, which you probably want to get to, obviously there was a lot of stories last week about Ten Hag and whether he's under pressure. There were some stories saying that he was. And then there was some strong outright denials from the club put out to people that he absolutely wasn't, that they're not looking at other managers, and that they're not, what would be the word for it? They're not even considering making a change. Now, this is where this gets really complicated, okay? Because right now you have, to some degree, at United, a bit of, you have almost two Manchester United clubs here ongoing. And in politics, you would call this, you might look at this like, especially it's the right time for it because it's November, but in US you'd have politics where in November next year the president will be voted on, okay? And if there's a change, which is probably likely one way or another, frankly, but if there's a change in president, the president will remain in place for two more months. And he will be able to do absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing he says matters.
Right.
Nothing he thinks matters. Nothing he wants to do matters. But he will still tell you what his plans are. Congress will be in the same situation where there's personnel and people changing and the balance of powers are going, but nobody can do anything. And for about 2 months,
pardoning, for getting a few pardons out.
Right. A few pardons and things like that. Right. Yeah. But nobody can do anything. Budgets are going to be stuck. They're not going to be able to approve new spending. They're not going to be able to do anything. And they call it like a lame duck era. And they have this gathering of them, you know, and it's like a congressional session or something like that, but it's a lame duck thing because nobody has any power to do anything. They can sit there and talk and make their plans and all of that, but nothing's going to happen. And to some degree, that's where United are at right now because of the INEOS thing, which is moving forward. And so there's a couple things that are true. The current management at Manchester United have no plans to change the manager. Richard Arnold is not changing the manager. John Murtaugh is not changing the manager. I don't think they can. I don't think they're going to get a dollar approved from Joel Glazer to sack the manager, even if they wanted to, and they're not going to. Okay. And so that's where they're going to say, we have no plans to change the manager. I wouldn't write off reports that say that they're looking at other people because it's all about who you talk to. And I wouldn't write off a report from the Times, specifically including Matt Lawton, who has covered the INEOS-led takeover pretty much from day one and has very good sources on that side of it and potentially as well then at well above, because there are people above Richard Arnold at the football club. There are people on the board. There are people close to the Glazers. There's people closer to the INEOS. There's people in this transition. And so a lot of it's going to depend on who you ask at this point in time. If you ask the club, Ten Hag is totally safe. The reality, as I understand it, with INEOS and the plans moving forward in Ten Hag's position, they don't want to sack him. They don't want to make a manager change. They're focused on making a change at the CEO level and likely bringing in, as we talked about before, Jean-Claude Blanc as the CEO, at least for a while. Bringing in very, very likely, to replace at director of football, Paul Mitchell.
Of course.
Those aren't the only appointments. There's a lot of smaller appointments that'll be made in retrospect with that. But their focus is on the executive down, building a top-down football club, right? Mm-hmm. Replacing the whole football board, all of that. They don't want to have to replace the manager right away. Mm-hmm. They don't. That doesn't mean they're not going to be thinking about it because you have to. Yeah. That's one of the downfalls of the Glazers as a football club is they don't make other plans. You know, they don't make what-if plans. They just do something and then they hope it works. And then if it doesn't work, they're shocked and they've got to scramble to figure out what they're going to do next. And that's why you see it ping-ponging back and forth between managers and things like that. So to be very clear, INEOS don't want to let go of Ten Hag. They don't want to sack him right now. They don't want to make a change at the moment. They would at least like to have him see out the season and see how he does under new management, communicate their ideas, communicate their plans, communicate their goals and intentions, get his, see what he can do, and see if they cannot turn it around within his project. At the same time, they are going to be looking at parallel plans because you have to. If he loses the next five games, he can't stay. And it's, you just have to, even if you don't want to. And that's the situation, essentially.
Every football club, right, especially in key positions, has to think about contingencies. If De Zerbi walks out of Brighton tomorrow, they will already know three or four candidates that are suitable to replace him based on, you know, because the sporting director is going to say, this is the way I want our team to play, and then we'll do everything derivative of that. This is the people, the coach, based on these principles, you know, and this is something United have never been able to do. You know, they don't understand why you can't go from Mourinho to Solskjaer because they don't understand he doesn't know how to play with these players. And it's, you know, I mean, I was even going back looking at Mourinho comments saying we had to compromise United's style based on the players that he had. So was looking at this, was looking, you know, at Solskjaer and that interview with Andy Mitten was like, look, it was obvious we had to play counter-attacking football. We couldn't dominate the ball. Yep. We got Bruno Fernandes. That them now we could dominate, you know, patting games, so we weren't playing counter attack, and then we were able to, you know, not have to sit back like that. And of course, this is partly why they bought Maguire, because they were always sitting deep, hitting quick. You know, he wasn't bought for a high line. So I would like to see United keep Ten Hag. I still think he's an exceptional manager. I think that it's easy to be knee jerk and say sack a manager, because this is just, you know, that's instinct. I get it, right. with United, you always have to take other things into consideration because the absolute chaos behind the scenes. I've said this, I believe Pep Guardiola would find himself in the same situation. Like my comment again about Luton, you know, Pep Guardiola could not play the style of football at United that he plays at City. Impossible, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And so you'd have to adapt it towards the style of the players that you have. So I think for Ten Hag, you know, if you look at his signings, a lot of them are, yeah, he sent some core players, no doubt, but there's a lot of loans, there's a lot of frees, there's a lot of this. You know, I mean, it's that's fine if your goal is just to finish top four and you're, you know, yep, we'll compete with the teams in the top four. If you're trying to win the league, you know, that's impossible. You just can't do that. I mean, when was the last free transfer City signed? I think it was Ortega, the keeper. There's nothing wrong with that, but there's no way City are building their midfield around a free transfer that's coming in. I'm not knocking Ericsson, but, you know, he doesn't have the legs anymore. So I would like to see Ten Hag work in a structured environment that's set up for success where they support him. And if they don't want to go with Ten Hag, there's proper thought an evaluation put into a replacement and say, okay, you know, because I don't want these people to sack Ten Hag because they've no idea what they're doing, right?
Yeah.
That's blatantly obvious. Also, as we know, there's a lot of issues going on behind the scenes between, you know, the Glazers, Richard Arnold. There's friction there for the first time, you know. Mm-hmm. There's question marks over Collette Roach. And so most of these people in key executive positions and even on the football side are already looking for new jobs. So Ten Hag's sort of on his own here. You know, if you, you
yeah,
if
yeah,
for a signing, you know, who does he go to? John Murray is not going to help him. I mean, there's been some question marks over who's been leaking United's team sheets to certain teams. You know, so there's a lot going on that, you know, I want to be careful what I say here, but people, just to say, there was discussions between Ten Hag and Ineos, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which didn't thrill John Murta and Richard Arnold, right?
Mm-hmm.
So some friction there. Please, if you're an aggregator, don't put this out. I don't want this come back, right? There's no real harmony inside the football club from any of the departments that are supposed to integrate to support each other. I mean, what you see on the pitch is pretty much what you see off it. There's no cohesion. There's, you know, everyone's pissed off. So that needs to settle down, and there needs to be a sporting department, you know, that is calibrated just for sporting success, and that's how we're going to determine your success and failure as a player. We talked about this earlier. I'll finish up quickly. The one thing that I'm not sure about, and I've been thinking about this, one of the main reasons why it was difficult for United to be sold is because of the bylaws with the fact that you need consent from all six of the siblings to sell United. And that could never be accomplished, right? Because they all have different ideas of what should be sold. And of course, we could argue the legitimacy of the Qatar offer, but they couldn't get any consensus on what they should do. So my question is, how is Jim Ratcliffe, if he's going to have a pathway to ownership enshrined in a contract, he's still going to have to deal with the same problem. So I would assume that he's got that in locked-in price. How did he get all six siblings on board to agree? Because if he didn't, and he's got to confront this issue 3 years from now, I'm not confident. So
yeah,
how did he get this?
Well, for sure. And I think one of the reasons is, one of the hints to this that I've mentioned, and otherwise I'd be very worried, is that he got all six siblings to vote yes already. Mm. They voted yes in May or April or May, maybe even twice. I don't remember. But
what did they vote on is the question.
Yeah, well, apparently they voted on the offer that would give him majority ownership of the club at that time, and they voted yes, but of course it was held up by six votes no on the board against them, which created a deadlock. One of being Richard Arnold's, which is a little bit of a hint into the issues that have formed.
Yeah, when Richard Arnold and Jim did not get along.
No, they didn't. And the Glazers are not super happy about Richard Arnold. And there's even stuff about Richard Arnold and Qatar and all sorts of things, right? It's a bit of a mess.
Mm.
But they already voted yes on it. And it was held up for these legal reasons because, of course, they weren't going to ignore that their legal counsel voted no for a specific reason, which was potential of lawsuits and things like that, that could put the you know, the sanctity of the deal into question. And that's fine. That's been the, I mean, that's been it. If you think about it, they voted yes in April. It's 7 months, 7 months ago now. Mm-hmm. It's taken 7 months to work through, when you had kind of a general agreement, these details. That's how long it's taken to get there, you know, from a general agreement on, or maybe it was May. Either way, it's been 6 or 7 months from when they had a general agreement on the price of the club to figuring out a way that it could actually get done and structured. And not a big part of that, it comes down to the six Glazer siblings. And some of the things you're looking at, like one of the stories obviously that came out was that there's going to be $250 million invested, $350 million, right? Dollars, or 243 million pounds or something, right? Invested by Jim Ratcliffe of his own money into the club. Now, there's a few ways that this can be done too. And these are some of the options that are on the table, without getting too complicated on the details of it. But, you know, the whole problem, obviously, with the whole thing is that the Glazers have felt that later on their value would be higher, that the club would be worth more later. And so you've got a bunch of different ways where when he buys in with his 25%, that he could get more ownership of the club. One of them is straight options to buy more shares, right? At a certain price that you would hope would be agreed upon, at least as a minimum, right? Like either the share price reaches this valuation, or it's going to be the higher of this number or the share price in order to buy future shares and things like that to get ownership. And that's going to have to be in the contract, right? The other option and possibility that comes into play is things like this, where you can put in money and then calling it debt or a loan will scare people. Mm-hmm. But don't forget that Roman Abramovich loaned over $1 billion to Chelsea and never asked for that money back. And that's not the point of it. It's a loan.
Same with my wife, bro.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
But that's about what she was me. I never did it back.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so, you know, he could put a loan in $350 million, let's say, to infrastructure. Well, by doing that, it's going to increase the value of the club. If he over time puts in 350, 500, 700, ends up putting in $1 billion and they end up with fixed up training ground, renovated stadium, more capacity, all of that, this will increase the value of the club. That loan could be turned into ownership, essentially, just to keep it really simple and not try to get into the detail of explaining it. But the loan could be turned into ownership. It can be turned into a situation where then the Glazers dilute their ownership and give him ownership. And they don't get any of the money, but the club is worth a lot more now. So even though they have less shares, or less, they have the same amount of shares, but less percentage, the overall club is worth more. And so they're not giving money away, because the Glazers are never going to give their money away. And so there's a few ways around this where money can be put in the short term to improve the club, and Jim Ratcliffe can get and become a majority owner or greater owner over time. And you're going to bet that those things are all put in writing, and that's part of the complications. And to add to that, it's going to have to be in writing. It has taken a lot of time. It's still taking time. But I do know for a fact that there's currently what are viewed as very near the end discussions going on. And I mean, like today, like as we speak, there are ongoing discussions that are supposedly, as far as I hear, really, really near the end, like not even negotiations anymore, but literal, like things putting on paper.
More so, operational stuff about
how
things are going to work. And, I mean, you would imagine you don't get to that point unless you have a broad agreement on
what
the acquisition is going to cost.
Yeah.
What would be the point of discussing?
Yeah, know, and a lot of the details, too.
You can't buy it, you know. Obviously, you need this badly.
Yeah.
They can't have someone like Richard Arnold in a position where they're completely disillusioned, or any executive for that matter, because the potential harm that they can do to you when they're in that situation is enormous. And I know that there's been a lot of concerns about stuff that's been leaked to the media. You know, Marcus Rashford, for example, we were talking about this. We got the story on, I think it was the Monday, that he had went to China. Wait, this is before, in fact, we dropped a hint on it last week's podcast. This is before it hit the media. And there's a few other tidbits of this story I'm not going to reveal, but United were obviously on damage control by releasing that he was there because they knew this was going to come out. I think they wanted to get ahead of it a bit. I know that Rashford is not particularly happy about this. He feels that there's people inside the club working against him, from what I was told. And so, obviously, this, you know, again, reflecting on the utter chaos that's going on inside the club. You know, Ten Hag was right to say, shouldn't have done it. You know, to me, there's just all time and a place. Marcus Rashford should not be going out the day United lost 3-0. I'm not saying he has to sit and lap himself in a dungeon, but I just think that especially out in Manchester United, we're at home, there's going to be drunk fans, there's going to be everything. And I just think, you know, you look at the optics of that and go, maybe probably not a good message to send right now. Not a hang on a fan's notebook. You apologize, you move on. But what's interesting to you is that he did not play Newcastle and did not play at the weekend. And one thing I will say about Ten Hag is he's applied. You know, I know you were saying that you're not sure how they get applied, but he's had no problems applying these disciplinary standards to the people at the very top, and rather than just using the people at the bottom as an example. It's a big risk that this, you know, to piss Marcus Rashford off. You know, at this moment in time, these are the types of people he needs in the club. But I think, do you think that his absence at the weekend was injury?
Well, yeah, I do. In this case, I do. Because there were some things I was told that on Friday evening, it was already known that he was not fit. And that, you know, it's probably the type of thing they just didn't want to give a clue to the opposition, because Marcus Rashford happens to be one of the few players at United that teams plan for.
100%. He's very motivated by all the managers.
Yeah. And you look at like the there was a comment from, I think it was Mickey Van de Ven, Tottenham, saying he was the toughest player he's played against in the Premier League and things like that. And people planned for it. And I think it was purposefully tactical to not reveal he was out until that morning. I don't think he was ever playing that day. You know, once he showed up, he didn't look like a player who's going to do a fitness test. I think he got off the bus and walked inside and they put the story out that he was out, you know, and not enough time for the opponent to react. And, you know, you don't want to give them an advantage over you. I think that it was actually between Eric and Marcus. I think it was as simple as a discussion, an apology, and they moved on. There's issues elsewhere.
Of course.
Through the club and Marcus Rashford that are very concerning as to how this happened and how certain things have gone on, but it's not in this case between the manager and between the player, which is quite interesting. And it's just a measure of everything we've been talking about here. There's really changes in leadership that are needed immediately. And by changes, I mean actual leadership going in place, because there isn't any at the moment. And it's very chaotic. And I think, as soon as you get that story that Richard Arnold is going to be replaced, you've got to make a move. Things have to happen quick after that. Because
last point before we go. It was announced last week that United were cutting back on overtime and cutting people's hours. If you look at United's trajectory since last summer, right, the Ten Hag's first summer, you know, the plan, first of all, he had got Malacia, he had got Christian Eriksen on free, and he had Lisandro Martinez. A modest spend, especially for a new manager. Then, of course, they panic and they go out and get Casemiro and Anthony, but that wasn't the plan. I mean, well, they were looking at Rabiot and Arnautovic, as we were talking about earlier. That was also the first year that they never brought the MUTV commentary team on tour. They made them stay in Manchester and do it from the studios. You know, and you look at, you know, last January, no money for players. Loans, that was it. This summer, you know, they go after Mason Mount, and this might explain why he doesn't 100% fit, primarily because Chelsea were flexible on the payment terms.
Right? Yep, we talked about that all the way back in summer as one of the reasons.
And so you look at the other stuff that he had done at that point, you know, had to get De Gea out, get Onana, you know, that all came afterwards. The Rasmus Højlund was one that they weren't, you know, really planning for. They certainly weren't planning on spending that. you know, and I was thinking about this because I spoke to United before they signed Anthony last year. And they had said, look, you know, we're not going to do it. You know, the price is too high, blah, blah, blah. And they go into it. And then I'd spoken to them this summer before they did the Haaland deal when Atalanta were putting out those numbers of 70 million. And they were like, well, absolutely no way. We're not going to pay that. That's outrageous. And then they end up paying it. And this is where, you know, you could see they didn't have the money for Harry Kane. And you look at everything else, you know, the loan deals, there has to be a break clause so we can, you know, terminate in January. They have been penny pinching, right? Mm-hmm. Really, really watching the bottom line in a way that they never have before.
Yep.
And we saw the financials, they look horrible. Like, I mean, United are at breaking point if there wasn't Jim Ratcliffe. I mean, where United are heading is for catastrophe without that investment. Why do you think the Glazers at this point, if they know Ineos was coming in, why they're so sensitive to the bottom line?
I think that obviously there's a lot of complications when you are bringing in someone like Ineos. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talked about at the end of summer that it looked to me like they were lining up for a minority investor. And I'll say why. And Jim Ratcliffe, in essence, is starting as a minority investor. When someone like that comes in, it's all about your budget and your finances and how it's going to work and how it's going to look and how it functions, because you're going to have to, and I think about it and I think, you know, if Jim Ratcliffe is going to walk in there and say, I want sporting control, part of the agreements are going to be how much money he's going to get to spend, right, and his budgets. And, you know, they're going to have to walk a really tight rope here, because the fact of the matter is Jim Ratcliffe's not putting a gun to their head, right? They want Jim Ratcliffe to come in. Mm. They want to get paid for this football club. They want to sell at the right price and make a lot of money out of this football club. They want this deal to work. That's one of the things I think people have a little bit backwards at times. They want this deal to work, and they want it to end with them getting paid $7-8 billion for the club from Jim Ratcliffe. And they're going to have to make some cuts. They're going to have to hold some hard lines, and they're going to have to change a little bit the way they do things in order to make that happen. And they're going to have to give Jim Ratcliffe as much resource as possible within the club to fix the sporting and do the things he wants to do for him to be happy and say, yes, this club is worth what you're talking about, and I'm going to pay you the rest of it for it. And I think that's part of what comes into play on all of this is, you know, they just have to do that. They're looking at it a different way, and they're out of options, because if he backs out now what happens? They're screwed. They're screwed. And that's why I think that it's going to go well. And I think it's going to go the way that he wants it to. Jim Ratcliffe, I think he knows it too. They don't have another choice. Do not have another option right now.
No. And I think one of the reasons why they've tolerated not taking dividends is because they know whenever Ineos put this money in, they're getting a big dividend out.
Yep,
and exactly. So, the one thing they can't do is nothing. And I've said many times before, we've said this before, I need to see all the details to see how I feel about
agreed.
It. But it's encouraging that finally we're going to have some priority put on the sporting side at the very least. Okay, my friend, we'll go ahead and leave it there. Thanks to all of you for downloading the podcast as always. Don't forget, give my friend a follow if you're not already. I'm sure you are. At Muppeteers, and subscribe to his content on his platforms. He does lots of good stuff outside of this. So thanks once again, folks, and take it easy. Cheers.
Thanks. See you.
Bye.